Welcome to the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, a companion series to the blockbuster exhibit, The State of Sound, a world of music from Illinois.
Welcome to the State of Sound podcast. I'm your host, Chicago writer Dave Hoekstra. In this chapter, we sit down with Angelo Varius, the versatile Chicago drummer and music historian. We do a deep dive into his remarkable career with John Prine, Steve Goodman, the Famous Potatoes, Mike Jordan and the Rock-O-Matics, Conway Twitty, Jethro Burns, Flying Fish Records, and much more. Thanks to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum Exhibits Director, Lance Towser, for production and editing. For more information on other podcasts and our exhibit, please check out musicfromillinois.com. And now here's our good friend, Angelo Varius.
Okay, I'm Angelo Varius. I've been a longtime Chicago musician, played with lots of different people, had a great career here, and my musical career sort of started out, my oldest sister was dating a saxophone player back in the day when I was like in my maybe 9 or 10 years old. And I lived in a neighborhood that was pretty hardcore Italian.
Where was that at?
It was in Galewood. And this is a neighborhood that had Sam DiStefano was down the block, and the Bucciris were down the block. And, you know, it's right next to Oak Park. So, you know, Accardo was in Oak Park. So there was a big Italian presence. And what goes hand in hand with mafia guys are jazz musicians, because a lot of Italians really got into the whole jazz thing. So, these guys sort of shepherded me, I looked up to them, and we happened to have a piano in our house growing up. And so these musicians would always say, hey, can we come over and just set up and play over at your house, because there's a piano there and stuff. And, you know, my sister would say, sure, come on over. And so probably on Fridays or Saturday nights, there'd be like 7 or 8 people jamming at the house. And it was great. I just sat there and took it all in. And one of the guys, the bass player, eventually made a name for himself. His name's Chuck DeMonaco. He went out west. He played with like Maynard Ferguson and all these well-known people out in the West Coast. I don't think any of the other guys really cracked the surface of recording stars, but I know Chuck did a really good job. And so since the drums would be left set up, I would jump on the drums and start playing the guy's drums, and that's how I got into playing drums. And I was really a jazz head. I mean, that's really where I was at. And when it was time for high school, I noticed that Notre Dame in Niles had an exceptional jazz program for high school. This band would tour. They would play with like well-known jazz musicians. So I said, I'm going to go to this high school, even though it was like 10 to 12 miles away from where I was living. I took the bus, went to the high school, got in the jazz band, really liked it, met a bunch of people. I was able to act like a jazz guy while I was in high school, so it was great. I also, a friend of mine by name Frank Caruso was also in the band. Frank is recorded around town. He's a really, really good piano player, sort of an Oscar Peterson type piano player. And we would do jobbing dates on weekends. We'd go play weddings. This is in high school. I throw my little suit on and we play a wedding, or we play a reception someplace. And so I sort of learned how to be a jobber and how to play music when I was maybe 15, 16 years old. And then a friend of mine, it was time for college, and I didn't even really plan on going to college. I was not really good with the studies. So one of the guys in the jazz band at Notre Dame was a guy by the name of Jim Pankow, who decided to go to Quincy College, which is this little college downstate in Quincy, Illinois. And he was a year ahead of me. He said, I'm going to be down there. Why don't you come down? You know, they have a good stage band. You can come down. So I said, maybe I'll go there. So I went down to go to Quincy College. And when I got down there, I heard that Jim Pankow had transferred. And he had transferred to DePaul. And it was at DePaul where he met his buddies, in the music program there, and they started the band Chicago. So Jim went off and made zillions, and I was in Quincy College. There wasn't much jazz stuff going on, so I started playing in, you know, rock bands in college like most people did. And it was the hippie era. This is like 66, 67, 68. So I started playing rock bands. It's the first time I was doing rock music. I'd only really done jazz before that time. And so when I got out of college, it was time to get drafted, but I didn't want to get drafted. So I applied for conscious objection status, which I was thankfully I received. And one of the things that when you receive that is that you cannot stay in your hometown. You have to travel at least 150 miles away from your hometown. So there's some sense of hardship put upon the idea that you're not going to be going in the Army. You have to serve in a capacity that helps people, and it's usually in a social capacity, but you have to live away from your hometown. So I left Chicago and I went to Davenport, Iowa, which fulfilled the requirements of being away from Chicago. And when I got to Davenport, I still wanted to play, and my, you know, I was a social worker out there, and I still wanted
to get into Bix.
Yeah, I did some tricks with Bix. Yeah. So I, you know, there's nobody to play with out there. There's, you know, it's not exactly the cultural haven that I would, you know, be looking for. And I ran into this guy who was an incredible bluegrass flat picker and just completely out of my element. I didn't know anything about country music, anything. But he had a little band that he used to play on weekends. He said, hey, I need a drummer. You want to come do this? And I said, sure, I'll try it. And it worked out great. And this guy, his name was Stu Stewart. And he was really smart and really good player. And I learned a lot. And I really saw the soul, the aspect of soul in country music. You know, my background was soul in the R&B side or in the blues side. But then I really was able to see the true, you know, like white ethnic soul that was coming out of country music. Stu's dad, I'm sorry, his grandfather was the original master of ceremonies at the Chicago Barn Dance. His name was Hal O'Halloran. And so Stu knew a lot of music, taught me a lot. I got into it. I learned a lot. I was a good student. And we started playing. And eventually, when my time was up, as a social worker, you know, I talked to Stu and I said, why don't we go to Chicago and see if we can make this, you know, successful? The band was sort of quasi bluegrassy and country.
Did the band have a name?
Yeah, it was Mr. Green Jeans. And we weren't pop enough. At the time, you know, country rock was starting to be popular, but this wasn't really a country rock band. It was more like a true believer, bluegrassy, sort of quasi-rock band. And we came, played a little bit in Chicago, and it was a little bit successful. And
where at?
We played places like Bulls and on Lincoln Avenue, where all the clubs were. We played Ratso's and we played those sort of places. And at the time, the owner of Ratso's was a guy by the name of Bob Briggs. And Bob Briggs had this idea to bring country music to Chicago. So he took over the Portage Theater in Portage Park, and on certain weekends he called it the Country Palace or the Portage Palace. And the first act he booked there was Loretta Lynn, and the second act he booked was Conway Twitty. And so we were booked to be the opening act for Conway Twitty, and So I was excited. This is the first time I, you know, played with like sort of a big name guy. Yeah. So we went to play our gig, and it went well. And the problem was that Conway Twitty's drummer, whose nickname was Porkchop, was completely drunk. You know, I always run into these drummers that have problems. He was really drunk, and he showed up late, and he was arguing and things. So Conway, in a fit of pique, said, I'm going to take this guy. And he just pointed at me. He says, we got 3 dates we're going to do in the Midwest. You go home. Go back to Nashville. So I said, okay, I'll go. So we played Peoria, I think, someplace in Missouri. I don't know where that was. And then another gig on the way to DuQuoin Festival or something in Illinois. And that was my Conway Twitty experience.
Did word start? I mean, you maybe won't say this, but I will. I mean, you're a very respected drummer in Chicago. When did word start getting out that you were accomplished and then, as you're pointing out, reliable? And I've known you. I mean, you've got a good business side. I think for some of these bands, maybe we'll talk about a little bit, you did some, you know, you took care of the bills and management. I mean, when did you feel like you were breaking through in that respect?
Well, when I came back to Chicago and was with that country band, I just realized that the promotion side of it, that I had to sort of put my foot in a little bit, because musicians are notoriously bad at that sort of stuff. And also because we were playing maybe one night a week or maybe once a weekend or something, you know, I wanted to play all the time. So I started to job out again, which I had learned about in high school. And I would offer my services to anybody who was recording. I'd say, you know, I'd play for nothing if they didn't have any money. I just wanted to play a lot. And I played with lots of different people. I did a lot of stuff pro bono. And then I started getting some studio work. A friend of mine, Bob Hoban, who eventually I got into the Brine Band, would do some projects with Flying Fish Records. And whenever they needed a drummer, I would do recordings with that. I did a jazz record with Bob. I did some records with Jethro Burns. So that started to expand my profile a little bit. I got a reputation of being like the country guy who could do this stuff. And then I also was doing one night a week at Orphans with a bunch of jazz guys on Sunday nights, just so I could maintain playing some jazz and enjoying that. And little by little, I sort of became, through the people that I ran into, I sort of became the call guy when something was getting put together. And that's what happened with Steve Goodman. Goodman had put together this band of like 9 or 10 guys, and they were playing New Year's Eve, as he usually did, at the Earl of Old Town. And he said it was a mess. They're just like, they couldn't, I mean, these guys were not used to playing with drummers, and so it just, there was no rhythm to it, and it was a mess. So Jim Tullio had asked me if I could come in, bring a snare drum or something, and play with Goodman that night. So I did, and Steve loved it. I mean, I did sort of think that I was able to solidify the mayhem that was going on stage a little bit. And then afterwards, Steve said, hey, you know, I'm going to take these guys out for like about 6 or 7 days. We're going to do a little Midwestern tour, you know, if you want to do that. So I did that.
When was that?
It was 77, I think, okay. Or the early part of 78. I'm not exactly sure. But John...
So that opened the door for Prime.
That opened the door for John Prime, because he came along just to hang out with Goodman. And I met him at the time. And so I did those dates with Goodman. And then immediately Steve started producing the Bruised Orange record for John. And then John needed to take a band out for the Bruised Orange record. And then we had auditions for that, and I was able to, you know, get in that band. And then, you know, playing with John Prine for like 5 years after that. So, yeah, that was a great time.
And how long were you on the road? You did road gigs with Goodman.
I just did that one
you
tour
Naperville.
With Goodman.
Were you in Naperville?
I was in Naperville. You were there.
Yeah, what was that show? Was
I heard rolling... you yelling, take your shirt off to Steve Goodman. It was pretty...
Rolling Blunder? What did he call it?
Rolling Blunder Review. And that was, that was right before the Prime Star
stuff happened. That was before the Prime.
So, yeah, we did about 6 or 7 dates with Goodman.
You know, I want to just touch a little bit on... And then I'll go into some Prime and Goodman stuff specifically. But I want to talk about your style, and I don't know how much of this will... But I've seen you, you know, I've never been a music critic, but I think you're tasteful. I think you know about space. But I went and got a surprise quote from Pat McLaughlin, songwriter, Nashville. You played with him, collaborated with Prime. in Pat's succinct way, Angelo is a great drummer who is all heart and has amazing R&B feel. Can you talk about that? I mean, you already touched on it, but I think in maybe in a world of where things get pocketed, and, you know, jazz and country and stuff, but you bring some of that to, like, you talk about the R&B.
Well, I think, you know, that's very nice of Pat to say that, but I think the thing with Pat is he has the most incredible R&B feel. Yeah, so that naturally, if, you know, I'm trying to think of where somebody's going, and I try to fit that mode of what he's projecting. So I think maybe that is, you know, that he brought that out of me because of the way he sits on, like, backbeat. So that's something that, you know, like, I would hear. Where with John hears things like marches. He thinks of, like, a lot of the songs that he does, he thinks of as like marches, like, I can't even think of the names of stuff, but there's a lot of two-beat things that he does, and he's always talking about, yeah, that's a march, that's a march. So I always, that would always influence the way I would play. I played a little more heavy on the ones when I was with John. I probably played more backbeats with Pat, because that's more where he was at. So, yeah, I just try to hear and see where people were at.
It makes me think of our friends down in Springfield, Lou Whitney would always say, I mean, did you feel you had to, his thing was, you always, we have to serve the song.
Yeah.
Did you feel it?
Yeah. One of my favorite songs that I got to play with John is Down by the Side of the Road.
Okay. Yeah, let's talk about that and we'll play some of that. Okay, talk about it.
And that song is really different from the other stuff that John does. It has almost like a Van Morrison feel to it. But it has some real crescendos and, you know, diminuendos, if you must, you know, like, add to that. And so the dynamics of that song I really enjoyed. And it's about a person that John really knows. It's like a cousin that had, like, emotional problems.
Kentucky.
Yeah.
I listened to it. Yeah.
And so there's some bitterness in what happened to her and the way he spits the stuff out. So I try to employ like a, almost like a, that feel of like a little bit of a menace in the way I played in certain ways. And I tried to be abrupt in the way I would go into like a, like end of accent or something. I choke the cymbals sometimes because I felt that was what he was doing. He was almost like the words were getting caught in his throat when he was talking about the stuff that happened to her.
And that was on Pink Cadillac.
Yeah. The fear's fading down by the side of the road.
Down by the side of the road. Okay, so that was Down by the Side of the Road. You know, I would, when I would write about John and talk to John again, I know you. I mean, that was a personal story, but I always thought he was like a news, he would always laugh at this. He was almost like a newspaper guy, the way he had an eye for detail and stories and stuff. What was it like to be on the road? Would you go out and get a newspaper? Would you listen to what was going on? Or was that not even on the radar?
Well, John, when we get on an airplane, when we pour ourselves on an airplane after a long night and we have to get an early flight going someplace, John would always have, and I remember this, he'd always have his glasses with one arm sticking out of the top of his sports jacket that he'd always wear, this like this black sports jacket. He'd have a rolled up newspaper and he'd have a couple magazines in the pocket of his jacket. And he'd get on an airplane and he'd sit in front of us. We'd be sitting like in the back of the plane. He'd be walking to the front and he'd sit down. And he'd take the stuff out and he'd be circling stuff and, you know, like, he'd look and, yeah, and he'd be, you know, identifying stuff that like hit him a little bit. It was almost like, you know, he reminded me of like a guy at the racetrack who's like, who's picking his favorites or something. He always like had something that he was like to trigger his memory and to like put into his memory bank to use like eventually. So I could see where, when you see like those phrases, all of a sudden there'd be a phrase that would jump out of a song that didn't seem like the words preceding it were going there. But then all of a sudden there'd be this phrase and it would just tie everything together. I think that was part of his skill, was being able to, you know, sew that stuff together. So the mosaic was just perfect.
That was fun. Talk a little bit about the Pink Cadillac sessions in Memphis.
Oh, you want to hear about that?
Well, you could do the PG thing. But yeah, but I mean, you know, I mean, Sam Phillips is on. I mean, talk, you know, for people.
Well, John was John Prine was really excited to have this band. I think the band sort of hit it a good time for him. He was in his early 30s. There's a band that really cared. We were not cultured players. It came from a studio.
Refresh the band again.
It was the guys in the band were Howard Levy and John Burns, and myself, and Tom Pekarsky. Mm-hmm. And we were Chicago guys. And he was a Chicago guy for the most part, grew up there. And I think he really liked this band being like a back pocket band. We were not session guys from LA. We were guys that when we would come back to Chicago, we would go to Parkey's and get a hot dog. You know, we were those sort of guys. And he really enjoyed having us. And so he really wanted to do a record with us. And he wanted it to be a back to basics record. That's what he was feeling. He was really tired of the, you know, like, the Electra Asylum sheen that was on all the records, the Jackson Brownie stuff, and how everything sounded a particular way. And this was right at the time when things were changing. There was like more punk stuff was coming out, and rockabilly was influences were coming back in. So he really wanted like a back to basics record. So we, so on the way to, one time we were playing a gig, he said, let's go to Muscle Shoals. We were in Nashville. So we went to Muscle Shoals and we did like six songs, you know, and got back in the bus and kept going. But it gave him a taste of what he wanted to do. And he used that as a primer for the record company about what he wanted to do. So he was looking for a producer. And, you know, he was really worried that a producer was going to not fit his vision. So he ended up with John and Knox Phillips, Jerry and Knox Phillips, who were the sons of Sam Phillips in Memphis. And they had their own studio, which had been built with the money from Elvis Presley when Sam Phillips, you know, like sold the contract. This is the studio that they created. He knew that they were, they would feel the same way about the record. They weren't going to be a slick producer. And so we went down there. We got a condo in Germantown. Mm-hmm. And then John's recording style was we would sleep till 4 or 5 in the afternoon. We'd go in around 10 o'clock. We'd have dinner. It, like, there's this one restaurant he really liked. We'd have dinner in Memphis. And then we would get to studio around 10, record till like 4 or 5 in the morning, and then do it all over again. And this went on for like 5 months. And, you know, it was quite an experience because we wore out one engineer. One guy, after working in those conditions, like quit after like 3.5 months. And John brought in some special guests that would play on it. Billy Lee Riley, who was a really famous old rockabilly guy who never really made it like the other rockabilly guys, but everybody respected him because he was just a real talent. He came in, did a couple sessions. In fact, those things ended up being on the record. He brought,
Yubanky Stomp was on the record.
Yeah, but that wasn't what he did. And then, he brought in Don Everly, who walked in, and Don, we were all pretty much wild men by this time. I mean, it was 10 o'clock at night. We'd get in there. We were pretty wild. And I think Don Everly was a little taken aback by that. So he didn't end up, tried a couple things, but didn't really happen on the record. And then he brought in Dickie Lee, who was a Memphis guy who had Patches. That was his big hit, was Patches. Anyway, he was hanging out at the studio because he knew the guys. And all of a sudden, we heard this thud in the studio. And Dickie Lee was so stoned that he fell over and landed on his head in the studio. So that was another experience that we had in Memphis.
Now, how did Sam, did he do Saigon? How did Sam come into the fold?
Sam, one day, well, Sam's wife came in and made banana cream pies for everybody in the band. And the studio was great. It was like it was locked in time. Elvis's gold records were on the wall, and it was very, very vintagey 50s inside. It was just great looking. And she came in and she put these banana cream pies there for the boys to have, and they were almost unedible. I mean, they were just, somebody took a bite and they just, you know, she did not have the skill of a great baker, but of course we ate them because she was there. And Sam, near, I think two-thirds through the sessions, Sam came in and was putzing around, and we were all like, Sam Phillips is here, you know? And he was just putzing around, hanging around, looking in the tape room, walking around. And I guess Knox told us later that he could always tell when Sam was like interested in the project because he just wouldn't leave. He'd be like, you know, like in the way and around and making his presence felt. And eventually he made his way into the booth, and he was standing beside his son. He was giving suggestions while we're doing takes. So eventually he gets on the mic and he goes, John. We hear this voice. It's like the voice of God.
Yeah, the voice of God. Yeah, yeah, right.
John, why don't you try with a little sex? And, you know, here we are with this God, Sam Phillips, talking to us, and we're all, like, sort of taken aback. But after a while, we got into his rhythm and what he wanted to do, and we started following his directions. It seemed like we shouldn't do anything we're doing because it was out of the flow of what we were normally doing in recording. But eventually we got around to feeling his way. I remember him telling me, Angie, when you hit that drum, I want it to stay hit. You know what I mean? I had no idea what that meant. But I said, yeah, Sam, of course. I'll hit it and it'll stay hit. So we ended up with two tracks with Sam. And it was
so what was the other Saigon and what was the other one?
Well, God, now I've got to think of what the other one was. Yeah, I wonder if it was one that ever got released.
Oh, okay.
It was a great experience, and you know, probably one of the highlights of my life. Highlight of my studio life. I mean, to be able to have Sam Phillips, who had not produced anything for decades, to come in and want to produce. And then I think that probably opened the door for his ears a little bit, because I know a few years later he did U2.
Yeah.
And so I think he was a little more open to maybe trying something outside of what his deal was.
What's it like for you to go back and listen to that stuff now?
It sounds different because the way we originally did it, it was very mono-ish. But as time has gone on, they've remixed it to try to clean it up a little bit. You know, it's hard when you hear yourself to separate what you were doing specifically at that time. It's hard to have the distance and listen to it objectively. Yeah. And anything I've done, it's hard for the subjective not to fall into it. So, you know, I'm my toughest critic, you know, so I don't want to comment on that.
So, the prime years and when?
Like 82, I think, was the last time we played a gig with him. We did, I think 81, we did, Carnegie Hall.
Okay.
And then we did a couple other dates. And then we came back and did a couple dates in Chicago. And then he just started doing stuff on his own. We got a gig as the Famous Potatoes, doing a theater gig in Chicago at McCormick Place, where we played a band. Oddly enough, we played a band in a production of this thing called the Magnolia Club.
Oh, that's right.
And John came in to see it, and we did that. It only lasted, the remake only lasted for, like, I think 2 months or so. The original I had done with a different band at Victory Gardens Theater. That was in 77 or something. And that ran for 6 months, and there was talk of it going to Broadway. It never happened. And then when the same producers The guys who wrote the show wanted to redo the show. They called me and I said, ah, I got this band. They just got done playing Carnegie Hall. You want to use? And so we, that band, which was the Prime Band, did, the Magnolia Club for a couple of months. I
forgot about that.
Then we started gigging around Chicago and,
So how did, and we'll have to do, again, do a whole explanation, but how did the Potatoes form into the Rock-O-Matics? And I, again, I want to explain to people how big the Rock-O-Matics were. Same thing, Orphans, Fitzgeralds, Mike Jordan. Let's talk about who Mike Jordan was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Mike Jordan was one of the whole bunch of folk guys that were part of the sort of the second tier underneath Steve Goodman, John Prine, Bonnie Kolak. They were sort of that second tier of guys. You know, Bill Quaitman and,
would you put Dundee in there?
Yeah, Tom Dundee yeah. and those people. Yeah. Betsy Redhead. Yeah. So, a lot of them started to get into playing with bands. You know, they saw that the folk thing, you know, maybe be better to play with bands. And Mike had started a band and I liked them. They were a really good band. And then, we had been playing as a four-piece band, just the Famous Potatoes, which was Bob Hoban, John Burns, myself, and Tom Pekarsky. But it got to be pretty hard as a four-piece because there was a lot of talking on stage because these guys were getting a little old and they would get winded, so they would just go on and do stories and think they were comedians. And sometimes it didn't really work really well. So I brought up the idea of this guy, Mike Jordan, plays sort of our music and he could be a front man and make it easier for everybody. And so they said, okay, let's try it. And that first gig was at Chicago Fest with Mike Jordan. And it just from that point, it really took off. That band became hugely successful in a local Chicago way. We did an concert at XRT. You know, we played a lot of different places, and it was fun. But if you don't get a record contract at the end of the rainbow, it's hard for a band to continue. So after a few years, the Potatoes sort of drifted away from wanting to continue doing it, which is understandable. And then Mike Jordan wanted to continue doing something on his own, and he put together this band called Mike Jordan and the Rock-O-Matics. Tim Tobias was the keyboard player in that band. John Siegel was the guitar player in the band. And then Tom Pekarsky and myself played in that band. And it was similar to the Potatoes. We were very successful. We were like the house band at Fitzgerald's and had a really good career that went for a while. And then I, after a couple years, I just figured I was getting into my mid-30s. I had a couple kids. That I wanted to take care of, and it just, you know, counting money off at the end of the night and saying, okay, this is how much you need, this is how much we pay for gas for the van, that sort of got pretty old for me. So I decided I'd get a regular gig and stop playing music, and which I did for a long time. And then, you know, I drifted back and did a few things as time went on, like when Pat McLaughlin would play in Chicago, I played with him a little bit. Yeah, I just moved on and did some other stuff after that. One gig I did with Mike Jordan and Rock-O-Matics is at Metro, Jerry Lee Lewis was coming to town.
1983, I have that down. Yeah.
Ah, what a day.
May
what a 8th, year.
May 8th, I think.
And we were set to be his opening act, and I'd known Jerry Lee's band back in the day with John Prine because we'd run into each other a few times. In fact, one time we ran into each other at the airport. We had just left the studio where we were doing the Pink Cadillac record. And I think Jerry and Knox Phillips were telling Jerry Lee Lewis stories about how he would shoot out, you know, like he'd take his gun out and shoot out the studio occasionally and get all upset. And so we went to the airport to fly to L.A. to do a couple gigs. And there's Jerry Lee who's going to be in our airplane. We were like, oh, shit, I hope he doesn't. You know, shoot out an window in an airplane while we're flying to L.A. And his front guy, the guy who did all his music stuff, was Kenny Loveless, who'd been his bass player for years and years and years and years. Yeah. So when at the gig at Metro, I went over to Kenny Loveless and said, hey, Kenny, it's been a long time. I haven't seen you in like maybe, you know, like 3 or 4 years. How you doing? And he was, I mean, he had no recollection of who I was. He had been on the road with Jerry Lee for, what, 35, 40 years? I'm sure everyone had blended into everyone else, you know. And he was pretty numb at that time. So that was my connection to Jerry Lee, but it never went further than that. Because I wanted to have a chance to talk to him, but I didn't talk to him at that time.
It's like a cherry's hanging on a tree. Your red lipstick, it looks so good to me. I want your red lipstick.
That was Red Lipstick. You probably played that at my wedding. You were my wedding band.
No, I wasn't your wedding band. I was gone by that time.
Oh, you were gone.
I was gone by that time.
Do you know what you know? That Mike Smith was I think that was a co-write with Mike Smith.
I think so, yeah. I played on the single that he did, the Red Lipstick single.
That's the one, yeah, that's the one I got. Yeah.
And then, it was right after that that, I decided I was going to move on. And he had like two or three drummers after that.
He did.
Yeah, and the band always sounded really good.
Yeah.
And then he had that tragic end.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about, and we'll kind of wrap it up, maybe play a little Goodman here too before we wrap it up. But talk about, we kind of skated over some of the other people. I want people to know about your work with Jethro Burns. Tell people who Jethro Burns was. And then you dropped into the Goodman world, and you know, he played with Steve. But talk about Jethro, Homer and Jethro.
The guy that I was in the prime band with, John Burns, was the son of Jethro Burns. And Jethro Burns had a historic history as a country humorist and musician. His musicianship was always on the side burner because this guy he played on the Tonight Show like 30 times or 40 times. Johnny Carson loved him, and they would come out and do their parody songs and really, really funny. But he was an exceptional musician.
Mandolin.
Like a jazz mandolin player. Yeah. He played almost in the style of Django Reinhardt. And, when it was time for him to do some records, I got the call to do a couple of the records with him on Flying Fish Records. And it was a lot of fun because he really could stretch it. The shows that I did with him, because I did a couple shows, I think Amazing Grace, I did that a couple times with him. And he would tell all his stories and try to be funny, but his playing was just exceptional. In fact, after he did those records, he and Steve Goodman were almost like a duo. Steve would take him out, and they toured for a couple of years or 3 years as almost like a duo together.
Steve had great affection for him.
Very much so.
Yeah. I suppose they both had such a great sense of humor, too, right?
Supposedly.
You want to talk about Pickles? I don't want to, you were with him for a long time. Well, Pickles, the bass player. I went back in some of the stuff I had written about him over the years. I didn't know. I'd forgotten that he was from Humboldt Park originally. But talk about who Pickles was.
Tom was a really strong bass player. He looked like Popeye. He had these huge arms. He used to weightlift all the time. But he was the most gentle soul, and he was just a wonderful guy. I traveled with him with Prime for those 4 or 5 years, and then we were in two or three succeeding bands after that, so I spent a lot of time with Pickles, and we got along really well. He was just a really natural, wonderful guy, and a really good player. The thing about Tom is he was very loyal to John Burns because John gave him his start, and then there was a little bit of disaffection when he decided to leave John Burns' band and play with Mike Jordan. But he and Mike Jordan became fast friends. They were sort of like best friends during that whole career with Mike Jordan and the Rockmatics. He really took it hard when Mike passed away. But I have great affection for all his time. He was the guy, when we travel with John, he would put on a robe when we get on the bus and go, "Who wants a white Russian?" And he would mix white Russians for everybody on the bus. He'd have this like Japanese robe on, mixing drinks for everybody. So that's one of my great memories from traveling on the road.
In researching this, of course, I took this seriously. I was going back to some of the, I interviewed Pickles a lot, but he talked about Brian as a band leader. He said, John isn't really like Doc Severinsen and telling you what to do. I mean, was that kind of accurate? Was John pretty?
Yeah, loose? John would sort of let you do your, he'd never say do this part or that part. He never specified anything. If he didn't like the sound of something, he would just stop doing it and then maybe come back to it or, you know, later. But he'd never say play this part or why don't you do this or why don't you do that. Yeah, we were sort of left on our own. But he must have liked what we did as a band because, you know, he did want to have us around.
Isn't that the best way? I mean, maybe you've been with other people who were, you know, I think about journalism, people get in my way. But I always remember Ken Nelson, you know, from Capitol Records. And Haggard would tell me this. I mean, Nelson would produce those records, just stay quiet. Just let them do what they want. But as a musician, is it best to have the liberty?
You know, who knows what the right way is. Yeah, I know a friend of mine was playing with Buddy Rich, was a trombone player with Buddy Rich. And I went to see the band one time, and he said, you know, like, I was waiting for him to come back afterwards.
Uh-huh.
And he, when the band was done playing, and he didn't come up for a long time. So finally, he came up, and everybody in the band came up from where they were, the green room or something. They all had red faces because Buddy Rich had been screaming at them about all the stuff they did wrong for the past 20 minutes. And they just look ashen. So I thought, boy, that's a gig I wouldn't want to do, is play with Buddy Rich.
This is great. Thanks for taking all this time. I asked you to pick up Brian and Goodman's song. So you took Banana Republics for Steve's. So why don't you set that up, Banana Republics?
Well, you know, that's a song that I think Jimmy Buffett sort of took over from Steve. But I always like the thematically, the structure of it. And I always thought it pictured something that was very recognizable, whether you had been in that experience or not. I thought, you know, that's a song that it was a great snapshot. And, you know, after I was done in music, I traveled a little bit, and I had a business where I was importing furniture from Mexico and South America. And I would be down in different places, like in either Mexico or in South America. And I did see very definitely that experience. I saw, you know, like expat Americans that were just sort of like hanging out. And so I thought Steve did a very poignant way of capturing that experience.
Down to the Banana Republics, down to the tropical sun, come the expatriates.
Yeah, talk about Goodman and the Cubs. Since Go Cubs Go still has a life, but tell the stories about going to the ball game with Steve.
Well,
and then I think that'll be about it.
Yeah, Steve was, you know, he was a huge baseball fan. In fact, our manager at the time, Al Bonetto, who was the manager of both Prine and Goodman, would say that sometimes they'd be driving to a gig and Steve would see a baseball game, like it'd be like a Little League game or, you know, see a stadium. He'd say, we got some time. Let's pull over and watch a couple innings. And Bonetta, who was not a baseball fan.
Goodman would say that. Goodman would just want to pull over. Yeah.
And Bonetta's like, damn that Goodman. You know, we're late. We just made in time, but he wanted to watch like a couple innings of this baseball game someplace. But he would go to, he would go to baseball games, like Cub games, and he'd bring this little miniature guitar, and sometimes he'd bring his daughter, and Bob Hoban would sometimes bring a fiddle, and I'd bring like a tambourine or something, and we'd sit in the bleachers, and Steve would like play songs. And this is back at a time when people knew who he was. I mean, now if you tried to play Steve Goodman's song in the bleachers, they go, "What the hell era is this?" But you know, it'd be great. He'd be leading songs between and cheers.
I didn't know it went that far. Wow.
The word would come out that he was coming to town, or my friend Bob Holman would say, hey, Goodman wants to go to the game today if you want to come. And we'd walk from Bob Hoban's house, which was on Ashland and Addison, and we'd walk to the ballpark, and he'd bring Rosie, and, you know, we'd sit there and you know, have a great time at the game.
Now that makes me think of when we talk about the Go Cubs Go when that was recorded. I think Jordan, somebody called me. I was at Suburban Sun Times, but I was loyal. I couldn't. They wanted hand claps from people in the background and stuff. Mm-hmm. But talk about how that session came about. You know, a song that people here really feel now.
I'm not sure who was the person in the Cubs that reached out
McDonough?
To Steve. It might have been. Yeah, I think it was because he was there. He was there for the sessions. And so Steve got together all the regular Chicago folk people because he wanted to get them all a payday. And whether they needed it or not, he would add different instruments just to have them all there and get paid. And then the hand claps, everybody gets paid for that because that's what Steve would do. He was very generous. In fact, he even called me back a day or so later and said, "Hey, I think we're thinking of maybe adding a tambourine to this." And I go, "Sure." So I got another payday out of that. I came in and did overdubs with the tambourine, which I don't even think was ever added. And for Go Cubs Go, I get another paycheck from that besides the original paycheck.
Where was it recorded? Remember the studio? No big deal.
It was where he did the Prime record. Hank Newborough's studio.
You don't remember who else was there?
At the time? I think everyone was there. I think all the folk heads at the time were there.
Wow. How, last question on him in baseball. I mean, how hard did he take a loss? That was, when you guys were doing that, maybe it was kind of a lean time in the 70s.
Kind of a lean time.
But I mean, did
was there ever a time that was not a lean time? I remember he had made a poster. This is the year that they traded Matlock for Bobby Mercer, and he made a poster of Bobby Mercer, a rocking chair for Bobby Mercer. If you remember the story, Bobby Mercer liked to bring a rocking chair in and sit in the clubhouse in a rocking chair, which epitomizes everything about the Cubs, that a guy, instead of getting fired up for the game, he'd be sitting in a rocking chair. So he had Bobby Mercer in a rocking chair, and he had his daughter hold up the poster Bobby Mercer, because Bobby Mercer was playing field, and that's where we were sitting. So, yeah, they were lean years. But, you know, grain of salt. You know, when you were a Cub fan, you realized it was mostly going to be lean years, and there's such a sardonic element to everything the Cubs did, that's where the fun came in.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Like Larry Bittner and losing the ball in the hat. I mean, those are moments that, you know, Cub fans cherish.
Yeah.
This has been the State of Sound podcast produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. To hear other episodes and more information about the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, visit musicfromillinois.com.